Marvin, will you please tell us where you are?
I'm in the car park.
What are you doing in the car park?
Parking cars. What else does one do in a car park?
Well, yeah. Okay. Stay there. I'll be down in a minute.
That makes two of us.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions, the official podcast of PlaidStallions.com. I am Brian, and with me to the left coast is Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And today's episode, you know, I want to, before we start, I find it ironic that the veteran voice guy doesn't do the intros for this podcast.
How do you mean?
Well, you.
You want to try it again or try?
No, I'm actually just addressing it. I just realized
you're right.
I'm
right.
Sloppy at intros, and it's like, yeah, well, you know, one guy has experience, and the other guy is me. But we've never addressed that.
We've never addressed that. No,
I always thought it was maybe an ironic kind of thing you were doing. I don't know.
No, I was always doing it, thinking, you know, you're doing all the legwork, and it's piggybacking on your site. So it felt more appropriate that you would be walking people through the house first.
I see. Okay. I always thought you were just
kind That's of like,
why. Well, it's little kid Kool-Aid. I'd better buy a glass. And
but I can certainly do it in my James Mason voice.
Well, that would be fancy.
Welcome to Pond Stallions, and don't smudge your toenails.
So James Mason wouldn't know what a podcast is, though.
He wouldn't. Yeah, but
confused.
If he came from the future, he might. You're right.
Well,
I'll do the next one. How about how about we trade off? We can trade off.
How about, like, we were talking about doing a mini show once a month as well. Why don't you do the intros for those?
Perfect.
Yeah. We'll talk about that later on in the episode. This is our 42nd episode, and that's not really significant, except that when I heard the word episode 42, without any kind of mention, I just texted to Jason, it's episode 42, and he had the exact same idea I had. You texted back, we got to do Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Absolutely.
So when that you get that kind of lightning, you go, well, yeah, now we got to do it. If you hadn't a bit, by the way, I would have just let it go. But because
I'm glad that I bit, because I always thought that of the two, I mean, I think I have a stronger love for Hitchhikers than you do, at least that's what I've gathered. But I knew that you liked it as well, or that you it was a big deal for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very, very fond of it. It's for me, it's just something I have. It's more like an old girlfriend.
Right.
I don't have any merchandise or memorabilia. I don't even have the books anymore. But it's, you know, it reminds me of being a teenager, and I really enjoyed it. So, I think you're a little more hardcore than I am, but I'm definitely not a novice.
Well, for me, it's one of those moments, and we talk about this now and then, those strange confluence of events that two things that are completely disconnected or not connected in any way, somehow come together in the pop culture world. Whether it's, being a Beatle fan, you know, Paul McCartney doing a theme song, doing Live and Let Die for a James Bond film. Or it's, Harrison Ford starring in the third Indiana Jones film with Sean Connery. Or it's the Monty Python team sort of mixing with the Beatles and finding out the Beatles were real fans of their stuff. And then George Harrison comes in out of the blue and rescues Life of Brian and sets up a film company. et cetera, et cetera. And so those strange things would happen sometimes. And one of them we talked about was as a kid watching Doctor Who, City of Death, and all of a sudden there was a cameo with John Cleese and Eleanor Braun in the gallery at the Louvre.
Yeah, playing art critics, right?
Or playing art critics, looking at the TARDIS, and it just knocked me out of my chair. Like, what was that? And that's kind of I'm building to something here, but that's kind of how Hitchhikers sort of came about or into my sort of realm, which was, you know, it had to be a late night thing on public television. They played the preview for weeks before this thing was going to air. I didn't know about the book, didn't know about the radio series from a few years earlier. And in 1981, they, you know, there were those lulls where we didn't get Doctor Who. So yeah. This was something to fill a lull. And if it was done at the same time during the previous season or how they worked it exactly. But I'm guessing not, because I'm sure they used a lot of the same people, model makers and, you know, masks or whatever else. You know, they couldn't have done it simultaneously, I don't think, because it was too much. This was a big, expensive show, believe it or not.
Really?
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, for the BBC, when you think about what they gave to shows per episode and what they expected, how many different sets they expected and costumes and how many characters might be walking around. It was a pretty, and it went very, very quickly.
Yeah.
But it had a you know, a Doctor Who sized budget, I would think. And it was a very, very popular radio show. So people were waiting for the television series to hit, and it hit in 1981. I remember seeing these previews on Channel 2 public television, finally watched it, couldn't quite get the gist of it, but knew that it was comedic. And so here's something was happening without me even knowing it, without initially knowing and going further back into the history of Douglas Adams to know how he crossed paths with Graham Chapman and the last series of Monty Python just a few years earlier. I'm watching it thinking, this really does have a Python-esque sensibility to it. You know, I'm 11 years old or whatever, but I can sense it because I'm obsessed with Monty Python. So that was really something. It was like science fiction, it was comedic, and it was British, and it had that sensibility.
Yeah.
And I just remember being completely smitten with the one thing I think that everyone agrees on that the show did incredibly well was the book itself, was the animation for the book. And when Peter Jones would start to speak, how the text would go across the screen and the images were like, it was coming at you very quickly. And
it was probably the highlight of it, special effects wise.
I think I kind of
came around it around the same time, like 81 or 82. Mm-hmm. I may have read about it in Starlog.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think from the initial PBS played it, I think, first, and then TV Ontario played it after. So I think I got it about once a year for a couple of years. It had that kind of, hey, this looks like something I'd enjoy.
Right.
It looked like Doctor Who. It was that kind of comic sensibility, you know, when you're kind of a young teen, preteen, it's very clever, it's very funny, and it's that kind of safe humor as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I gravitated towards it. And what was really funny, as I recall, you know, it aired once, and then a year later, it aired, I think, when I was in the eighth grade, and I'd forgotten how cheap it was, like how mm-hmm. cheap it looked.
Mm-hmm.
I found it looked cheaper than Doctor Who, even.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that may have played to its comedic effect.
Right.
But I just, you know, it was just kind of like a culture shock. And this is, you know, this is the pre-VCR days for you. So, you know, you caught it or you lost it back then.
Right.
So that probably had a lot to do with it. But it was so influential on me that I immediately asked my mom to get the books out of the book club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she got 3 books a month or whatever through the book mm-hmm. club, and I got Hitchhiker's Guide, Restaurant at the End of the Universe, and what, I can't remember the third book, or is Restaurant the third book?
Restaurant's the second book. The third book was called So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
No, Life, the Universe, and Everything.
Life, the Universe, and Everything, but that didn't come out, I don't think, until...
82.
80... He's 80. Which I said I was in 82 or 83. Was it 82?
82. Yeah, those are the three books I got.
And then Fish, I think, came out in 86.
84 or 85. Yeah. 85, okay. I remember being in the 10th grade, reading it and hating it.
And, yeah.
I lent it to a friend of mine. By this point, that was probably the last contact I had with the show. My friend, I remember he loved it, and then he got really into the Dirk Gently series. And followed Adams right to his very early death in terms of his content, because I made a lifelong fan out of this friend.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting that you say that about the fourth book, which, you know, we'll get into, we'll concentrate on the main story and the series and that bookend before we get to the other stuff, which we'll probably speak, you know, more briefly on. Hitchhikers to me is the perfect thing that Douglas Adams ever did. And he was a massive procrastinator. He was not someone that sat down and wrote morning, noon, and night. So even the books that he kept getting pushed to make another sequel to Hitchhikers and try something else, even those took forever. So however long he was going to live, and he didn't live very long, which is very sad. He died 49 years old. He wasn't going to leave behind a Stephen King-sized, you know, body of work. But when you look at some of the earliest things, and you look at the early, you know, permutations of these things, and even the radio series. So I get to the TV series, that up, and then I get the books, and I read the books. But I'm already noticing in the books there are different things that are happening in the books that didn't happen in the TV series, or it happened slightly differently, or something was added or whatever. By the time I get to Now, see, I didn't even get to the radio show. The next thing that I was able to get my hands on through Starlog ordering or whatever it was were the vinyl record albums of Hitchhikers. So those weren't even straight adaptations or recordings of the radio show. Those were special records made, truncated versions of the initial radio series.
I've never heard of those.
And the first one is a double album, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And the second one is Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And it's a single vinyl record. The entire cast is on there that were the same cast that were in the radio shows. But again, they all had to go into a studio and re-record this stuff to fit into that format, which also meant stuff that was in the initial, you know, 6 or 8 episode first radio series. Much of that was cut out just for these albums, and some of it, you know, ended up being in the TV series as well. Most of the TV series was not on the albums, and then some of it was in the books. And then as I got older and got, you know, was really getting more obsessed with getting stuff or finding stuff, in the late 80s, someone finally put out on cassette and CD a sort of official release of the 1978 radio show. And when you listen to that, you forget there were two series. Yeah. The first series is basically what we know as Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And the second series has bits of it in there, but it goes off in a completely different direction with more adventure and strange things and clones. You know, Rula Lenska's on there as a clone woman that's been cloned 1,000 times. And all this shit that never made it into any other version, really, of Hitchhikers. So what I'm getting at is, you know, by the time you get to that and then talk of, you know, a breaking through to America and maybe a U.S. television version or a motion picture, the story of Hitchhikers was constantly evolving and changing, and constantly he was adding or subtracting or beefing things up, or the framework was always there, which was, you know, he wrote the most average, everyday British man he could think of. Who
early 80s kind of guy.
Early 80s.
Because there's all these mentions of digital watches.
He's fascinated by digital watches, but it would, you know, loves
he
nothing.
He was really taking a piss out of that kind of, you know, that time period.
The time period and the character of a British man and the way they would respond to things.
Yeah.
And how you know, his friend comes to tell him that the earth is going to explode at the same time as someone wants to tear down his house to make way for a bypass. It turns out the Vogons want to destroy the earth to make way for a hyperspace bypass. But as the information is flowing, he's shocked and he's scared, and but within a few moments he's just wondering, okay, when can I go home now, you know? And before you know it, he's looking to try to get a cup of tea. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time fussing and fighting and crying and getting emotional over what just happened, which is a very typical British sort of thing. Like, keep your chin up, keep moving, don't talk about your feelings. And that's what he was really playing at. The one quick thing that I want to point out is there are two significant characters that did not make it into the television series that are from the radio series. The woman who played Trillian and the man who played Ford were different actors, did not make it into the television series. I want to say her name was Anne Sheridan, or is who played Trillian, I think. I don't know what the reasons were there. The reasons for not casting Jeffrey McGivern as Ford Prefect, the director didn't like the look of him and wanted someone a little stranger looking. Now, I love Jeffrey McGivern. I've seen him in a million things. His voice is fantastic. Even all the radio shows now. But the guy who played Ford Prefect in the TV series, I always thought would have been a great doctor. Yeah. It was right around that you know, fifth doctor kind of era. And here was this young, you know, good-looking guy but with strange green eyes that wore, like, you know, striped what seemed to be, like, cricket pants, sneakers – a shirt and then a vest sweater that with two different patterns didn't match at all. Yeah. He wore a jacket, like a little sports jacket or a schoolboy jacket, and carried a duffel bag. And he was the coolest guy in the show. Everyone talks about Zaphod being, you know, the cool hipster dude, but Ford to me was the cool guy in the show and totally unflappable. But so they didn't make it into the series, and you've probably seen them or heard them in other stuff that they did make.
I wasn't sure about Ford because the guy does kind of sound like him.
He does.
But the Trillian is very different.
Right.
But I just wanted to point out that I got cassettes of the radio series around 83. I probably listened to those 100 times. They're really good. And in fact, I would have to say that the radio series, which is the original thing this is all based on, is my favorite. It's, you know, because Adams' sense of humor is so based, it's not physical comedy, it's a lot of wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of clever dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
There's no better medium for that than radio. I mean, it's a printed word as well, but hearing two talented actors banter back, like, it really, even when it starts, it's just rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat.
It never lets up. I say that first, whether you're listening to the album or the first couple episodes of the radio show or the series, it goes, it moves. Like, there's no downtime. They keep moving. And the brilliance of it is, you know, in addition, I mean, to be fair, he was very influenced by Monty Python. He was influenced by them, by the show when it was on. It's two massive things in his life were Monty Python and the Beatles. I mean, it's true. Like, they were his religion. And he was influenced by Python when it was on, so much so that he wanted to get into Cambridge because the teams were Oxford and Cambridge, basically. He got into Cambridge. He wanted to get into the Footlights, which is what, you know, if you want to get into theater or comedy, the Footlights Review is what you really want to be a part of. And I don't think he got into it the first couple of years, but he eventually did. And then what, Graham Chapman had seen him in something or was impressed because he was going back as an alumnus or something. And as John Cleese had left, this is the cosmic weirdness we always talk about boy, if that person hadn't been in that and this thing would have never happened, you know. Cleese had left the fourth series of Python, which was only six episodes instead of the usual like 12 and 12 or 13. And so he had been impressed with something that Adams had done. And Adams ends up being, even if it's minuscule, but Adams ends up being one of only two non-Pythons to have ever contributed to a show when it originally aired. And it was a sketch in one of the episodes of the last season that he co-wrote with Graham Chapman. And then he actually his face, you know, he shows up in a couple of episodes. So it's like a lot of stuff that you do, they start grabbing that sort of pedigree and mention it to the next person. So, well, you know, he has written with Monty Python. Well, really, it was only Graham Chapman. Yes, but he knows the Python team. And just like, you know, that helped lead to getting Hitchhikers onto the air as a radio thing, then naturally it seemed to lend its way toward him being script supervisor on Doctor Who in 79 because of all those things combined. Hitchhikers kind of led to that, it's just really fascinating how that all kind of went. But the first, you know, two episodes at least, I think it moves, and beyond the sci-fi, beyond the trappings, beyond the,
There's a lot of wonderful little things in it, too. And I could be wrong, but I swear the construction worker that's tearing down Dent's house also voices the Vogon commander.
He might do,
And it's kind of a funny, like, you know, I'm tearing down your house, well, I'm tearing down your planet, you know. And it basically, it's trying to say that these, I guess they're, you know, just government workers.
They're all drones.
They don't give a crap.
Yeah.
And it's universal. And that's a very funny, you know, little thing. One of my favorite lines in the show, like I can see a lot of people not liking it because it's quick.
Yeah.
And some people don't like quick things, you know. I'm a fan of Arrested Development and things like that don't spoon feed you the jokes sometimes. So
it does have the rhythm of Arrested Development sure. And also, can I jump in? To be fair, also probably would be against it or have their walls up, because generally you can count on one hand the number of sci-fi things that were comedic that actually worked.
But most of them are British.
And the ones that do, most of them are British. Yeah, it's true.
And it's weird. Like, this thing is really British. I don't know if it inherently has to be, but it is.
Yeah.
And one of the things that – one of my favorite lines in it is at the start is, like, it's a bit like being drunk. And he says, oh, that's not so unpleasant. He goes, ask a glass of water.
Yeah.
And that's just it's a funny line.
There's a lot. In the same conversation, he says to – Ford says to Arthur, how are you feeling? And he says, a bit like a military academy, bits of me keep passing out.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so – and then there's just the throwaway kind of wordplay of, you know, Ford, what's going on? Would it be stupid of me to ask if we're okay or what's going on? And Ford says, no, it's okay. We're completely safe. We're safe. And then he says, ah. And then Ford says, we're actually in the cargo hold of a Vogon constructor fleet that just destroyed the Earth. And Arthur's like, ah, this obviously is some strange new usage of the word safe
that
I was previously unaware of. I mean, it goes. Every bit of it bouncing back and forth like that.
Yeah.
But what it does really well, too, is it takes the piss out of the big green bad guy that's really actually sensitive and wants to write poetry. I mean, some of it is very big and broad.
Yeah.
The two-headed thing with Zaphod obviously was never going to work as good as it should have.
Yeah, that's one of those things that works fantastically on radio.
On radio, completely built.
But, I mean, even the movie, and we'll get to the movie,
yeah,
they just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to deal with it for 2 hours.
Yeah. So it's now become one of my obsessions. I'm picking in the 80s there. I'm picking up everything I can to see what's going to happen next. Will there be other books? I remember getting, you know, Life, the Universe, and everything, and enjoying it. But then I went on to read later that a lot of stuff that was in there were disused ideas for a feature script, a Doctor Who script that he was working on as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish is basically just a romance, and there's not a lot there.
I can only remember one thing liking about that book, and that was a Marvin appearance where Marvin's dying or something, and as he's dying, he says something like, "Do you want me to pick that piece of paper up? Is that okay?" Like he's still being passive aggressive.
Yeah,
he says, he's dying.
Brain the size of a planet.
But I just remember really disliking that, and to be honest with you, you know, that was really, and this is what's so nostalgic about talking about this is that was really the time where, you know, rock and roll and girls took over, and it was like, you know, I stopped, you know, I had new tapes in my Walkman and new thoughts and new ideas, and I was sort of done with it. I kind of left it in the past, and I haven't seen the miniseries in probably 30 years.
You've got to, it's really,
you know what I want? I really hope to rewatch it before we did this, but you know, I'm moving and life is just taking me.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Places. I wanted to sit down, but I spent some time thinking about it, remembering stuff, and I'd listened to the radio show so much that I can still remember everything.
You got to get to it because there's some fun stuff in there.
I remember really liking the actor who played Ford in the. Got a goofy sense of humor. And,
David Dixon was the first. Again, and here's some crossover stuff. So we're talking about all these fun, you know, random cosmic things that happen when you go, oh, two things that I love or that never would have thought would have gotten in the same room actually happened, etc. And I'm sure you know most of this stuff. But within the TV series as well, Sandra Dickinson played Trillian, and she was married to Peter Davison at the time.
She has a really high voice, right?
Really high, squeaky kind of voice.
Yeah, you see, the radio Trillian is...
Yes, Anne Sheridan,
more
I think.
Dulcet, it's much, and she has a really deadpan kind of sense of humor. Like, there's a line like, you know, it was either go to space or be in the unemployment line on Monday. You know, because she had a big degree and no job. And
astrophysics.
I just remember, like, that seemed to be kind of lost with TV Trillian because of that...
her voice.
Bubbly
and her,
voice, and she's and they really, made her she's really like attractive.
A,
and
yeah, she looked like a Powerpuff Girl.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. That's a good...
But there's a famous scene.
She looked like the Kenny Everett girl, you know, like Kenny Everett's Captain Crimmon. She looked like that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, she did. And there's a great bit when they get to, you know, spoilers here if no one has read or seen or heard or checked out any iteration of Hitchhikers. When they do get to Milliway's, which is the restaurant at the end of the universe, the dish of the day comes by their table. And they're like, well, we'll bring the dish of the day out so you can meet you and decide which, if you want to kill him and eat the dish. And so the dish of the day comes out to talk to, it's this, you know, creature to talk to the table and say, why don't you try my rump? It's really good. I've been, you know, like working on that. And it's Peter Davison.
Yeah. I remember that was a big nerdy thing. Like he was
big nerdy thing.
Like it was, because there was no internet back then, I must have been in a Doctor Who fan club or something because I knew that was going to happen and it was all exciting, but I hadn't seen Davison as the Doctor yet.
Right, that would have made sense, yeah. Man, I remember him, someone at like a convention that I think the first one I think I went to ever in the Twin Cities, and he was there, and someone asked him to do his lines as the dish of the day.
Oh, really?
Which was bound to happen at some point at a convention in the 80s. So there's that. And then the guy that's the bodyguard for Hot Black Desiato, the big rock and roll guy that Ford used to know and party with and wants to go over, he's the lead singer of Disaster Area, the loudest.
He's the dead guy, right?
The dead guys. He's taking a year off. He's taking a year dead to get taxes off or something. He goes over to talk to him, and the big guy that picks him up, the bodyguard, is Dave Prowse.
That's right, Darth Vader himself.
So all these little, you know, tidbits that would sneak in, and as a you know, 11-year-old or whatever, 12-year-old, just going, oh, I swear that's Dave Prowse. And I would only know that through Starlog. You know, it's not like he was doing sit-down interviews much back then.
There was a big thing when I found out Dave Prowse was in Space 1999 as well.
Really?
Yeah, he played a monster in a...
He's also the bodyguard in Clockwork Orange.
With the big glasses.
Yeah. And I think I told you this story, that I was sitting next to Malcolm McDowell at a screening.
Yeah.
And he kept turning to me, making comments to the film. And then when Dave Prowse... I'll never forget, when Dave Prowse is there, and McDowell just turns to me and goes, that's Darth Vader, you know. I'm like, yeah, now I know.
Did you ask him a lot of Caligula questions?
I did. I asked, was it margarine or just butter?
Yes, yeah, that was number
one. And it got a big following. It got a big following in the States. They reran it. It ended up in Starlog and Fantasy Empire magazines, those kinds of things. But yeah, there wasn't
it burned the official. Brightly.
It didn't. I mean, I think there was a fan club, but it kind of was and it kind of wasn't. There were, unlicensed things that sort of got made. There was, there were two other things that started to happen now, too, is that Adams and John Lloyd wrote a book called The Meaning of Liff, L-I-F-F. And it was kind of a precursor to those. What are those things you pull off like once a day on a calendar where it's like a made up word and then they give you the definition of what the word is kind of thing?
Yeah.
It's called something, but they were the precursor to that. All these strange words they had made up, you know, the sound of, you know, or
the word of the day kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Exact level of distance between your fingertip and the ticket you need to get out of the machine to enter the parking garage.
Yeah.
You know, like that, things like that.
The first thing I realized, the first thing I guess I saw that I realized, oh, this thing was really popular, is in college I went to Ottawa to visit some friends a couple of times, and the most popular night, like Ottawa is situated near Quebec, so most people go to Quebec because you can drink a year mm-hmm. younger, mm-hmm. but the most popular bar downtown, at least in the early 90s, was called Zephod Beeblebrox's.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Or I think they just called it Zaphod's for sure.
Zaphod's.
But oh, yeah, that was, I don't think I ever went. But, you know, it used to be the joke, you want to go down to Zaphod's.
That's cool.
And well, it was kind of one of those, like, I know what that means.
It struck me at the time, too, because the band Level 42 had just started to sort of broke in America. Because of a song called Something About You on this album called World Machine. And they had come out of this early 80s white funk movement, jazz funk, white funk kind of movement out of a certain area in England. And, like the Mike Bush, they make jokes about Mark King in Level 42 because he would slap his bass with, you know, the thumb. He held his bass up on his chest. But they were called Level 42, and I remember thinking, you know, because I think I had that album, and it was a big album, thinking, wow, these guys named their band after, you know, hitchhikers with 42 in there.
Oh, yeah.
Too. So that there was that. There was, but they were kind of nerds anyway. But the other things that he did, so we'll get to some of the stuff that he did in a little bit later in his life, but one of the things he wanted to do with all this popularity and this thing that's so beloved was finally try to get it made into a motion picture. And
wasn't Spielberg involved or rumored to be involved?
I think Spielberg was rumored to be involved. I think, you know, Ivan Reitman was involved for a long time.
Yeah, that thing remember the back of like Starlog and Comic Scene used to have like things in development?
Yes.
And it just seemed like you'd read it every month. Oh, the Green Hornet movie's coming out, you know.
I remember reading about it in a sidebar in Q magazine, the British music magazine. There was a little sidebar, Douglas Adams. It was 1988 or 89.
Yeah.
And they were saying, how is the Hitchhiker's movie coming along? And I think at that point Ivan Reitman was involved, who had, you know, two or three years before that was Ghostbusters, which was massive, obviously. And I remember Douglas Adams' quote being something like, yeah, it's going along, you know, fairly well, but we are locking horns about certain things. And he said, I guess I'm finding the experience a bit like going to buy peppermint bonbon ice cream or mint chocolate chip ice cream and then getting it home and complaining about the chocolate pieces that are in the ice cream, sort of. And that was like 88. So truthfully, when he died at 49, this whole process had taken so long, gone on so long, that he eventually moved to Los Angeles. I think he was living in Santa Barbara or something.
Yeah.
To get closer to this development. Now, we all know the movie did happen in 2005, but he died 3 or 4 years before it, so he never even got to see it. But that's how long it took. And from what I've read about the making of that film, again, this is not about quality of it or whether people, you know, like it or, you know, whatever. It's that his stamp was in much of that film. Like the things that did happen that were different were his ideas. It went through dozens upon dozens of drafts and revisions and changes and everything. But I think it's pretty close to what he would have done or how he would have done it. And there you go. There's a whole new cast of characters. I mean, actors.
Yeah. Well, they couldn't get, you know, even though you want to, you want Simon Jones?
Simon Jones, yeah.
I can't picture as anything but Arthur Dent. I mean, I once saw him in a cold commercial in the 90s, and I went, Arthur Dent, you know.
That's it. Only Arthur Dent. That's it.
So what did you think of the film? Did you see it in the theater? You must
have. I saw it in the theater, and more than anything else that I've loved or was familiar with before I went into it, my expectations were very, very low, only in that when you know this thing by heart, I mean, truly, I know this thing. Like, I'm watching the first 30 minutes of it, and there are little, you know, bends and breaks here and there that are slightly different in the dialogue, but I can tell you every bit of dialogue that's going to happen in the first 30 minutes of the film. When you know something that well and it's that sort of beloved, you're either going to do something very different with it, or you're going to stick to kind of what it was and, you know, just go with it and realize it's never going to be the thing that you love as much. And having said that, you know, I like the radio show. I loved the books. I read everything, got all the omnibuses. I got, you know, all the Meaning of Lif books that he did, and the Dirk Gently books and everything. But my favorite thing is the 6-episode BBC series. Really? That was my introduction to it, and that is what I think of when I think of those characters and their locations and the designs and Marvin and Arthur and the dressing gown. I mean, that's it. That's the image I get for all of it. So nothing is going to quite be that, but you had Martin Freeman as Arthur, and all along Douglas Adams had always said anybody can be recast as any of these characters, any ethnicities or nationalities, but Arthur has to stay British. That was the one thing he was always insistent on. So you had Mos Def playing Ford. You had Zoe Deschanel playing Trillian, which I kind of get. Sam Rockwell doing Zaphod, which is great. I mean,
there's nobody better.
Yeah, I even wanted him to do more, but he was great. He bit into that thing. Bill Nye is Slarty Bartfast, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, the creatures are fantastic. The Jim Henson Muppet, whatever creature shop that did those things, they are fantastic. The sensibilities, the music. Stephen Fry doing the narration.
Yeah, you know, very, very good. And
you're not going to beat Peter Jones.
So the late Alan Rickman,
and then Marvin Alan Rickman is doing,
just like,
yeah.
If you can't have the original actor, whose name for some reason Stephen escapes Moore. Me now,
I kind of wish it would have been Stephen Moore, but I guess
it's neat to see Stephen Moore now. Like, he's been on a couple of Doctor Who's.
He has, exactly. But
he was Adrian Mole's dad back in the 80s.
I think it would have been more distracting if it had been Stephen Moore's voice coming out of that design of an android.
I agree.
So if you're going to change the design, then that's the way you should go, I think.
I didn't get to see it in the theater because something else premiered on April 29th, 2005, and that is My Daughter.
Oh,
so
that's a good
I was just looking at the Wikipedia going, why didn't I see this in a theater?
Well, that's funny.
I had plans.
I was busy.
I was not even at home. So I probably rented it when it came out on video several months later. I remember my wife doesn't have any sort of interest in it whatsoever. So it was just kind of me on my own.
Mm-hmm.
My initial reactions to it were, one, I didn't like Mos Def as Ford. And not because of ethnicity. I don't care about that. It's just that he was too... And maybe he was doing this because he's stuck with Sam Rockwell and he's trying to... But Ford was his own kind of crazy and funny.
Right.
And I just found... He was trying, but it was too low-key for me.
It was laid back. It was he was trying for the laid-back oddness instead of just the in-your-face walking through the room and, you know, not being fazed by anything. He just was – I didn't mind him. I
think – I just wish – like, there was a bit of a manic energy to the Ford of the radio show and the Ford of the TV. And I kind of wish there – he had kind of had a little bit of that because the guy's weird.
Yeah, he is.
And he's – he, you know, Arthur is supposed to be us – and he's supposed to be this guy that, like, you know, he looks at something and goes, oh, good, you know, like, I just didn't find that was there enough.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that was right around the time that I started my, I wouldn't say hatred, but my dislike for Zooey Deschanel popping into everything as if she's just got off lithium and she's just, every line out of her mouth is just, Arthur, did you see this? It actually, you can take it and it slices bread and it's like a little knife. Isn't that something? Like, God, could you get excited about something? That's when that whole thing started and she was already kind of bugging me. But then you've got these other great little bits where, like, Helen Mirren doing the voice of Deep Thought, which was a really cool way to go because it's a female voice instead. The whole thing with
politically correct.
But the whole thing with Huma Kavula and Malkovich is a footnote in one of the radio shows, I think. But they went nuts with that character.
Yeah, that was like. It's hard for me to. The other thing I didn't like about the film, although I did like it, it's people doing lines I've heard. It would be like somebody doing Duck Soup, and it's not the Marx Brothers,
right?
You know what I mean?
And right. That's what I was trying to articulate.
The problem
was in the kickoff was when you know something so well. There's a way kind of to do it and embrace it, and then there's a way that you just kind of do it offhand, and if it doesn't do it justice, you know, it's – and I mean, that's one of the things I had problems with Marvin. Like Stephen Moore and the physical design of Marvin is so perfect, and his delivery is so perfect. He looks like a crappy robot, but it's just – his delivery is just
– It has a – face has a deadpan – because it's like a happy toy robot. And I think at one point they even show a commercial where there's like this, you know, you have plastic pal who's fun to be with. And it's like,
fun to be with.
And it's like this happy Marvin.
Yeah.
And then you see the real Marvin and he's got this
clearly doesn't
grumpy
have
cat
that
speech, kind of face. And,
yeah.
And yeah.
Well, it's like his delivery, you know, as a voice, the way he moved himself was, you know, it's very different in Hangdog. You know, the conversation we talked about earlier where he's got his moment alone with Arthur and Arthur's, you know, I come from a planet called Earth, robot. Yes, I know. You go on about it. Sounds awful.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was beautiful. It had this. It had that. It was lovely. And he says, you know, this sweet sort of, did it have oceans? Oh, yes. Yes. Big, beautiful, wide, rolling blue oceans. Can't bear oceans. That's the way he moved. As well. Tell me, do you get on well with other robots? Hate them.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you get to Alan Rickman's thing, it was almost like he was doing kind of a Cockney. Yeah, let me make brain the size of a planet. I'll go and pick this up and do this over. It just didn't quite work. I mean, rest in peace, but it was good and everything. Oh, and the other thing too, back to another connection, was the voice of Deep Thought was Valentine Dial, who played the Black Guardian in Doctor Who.
Okay.
So there's another.
I didn't know that, but I recognize that voice. Yeah.
Another little connection. So as this is all going on, you know, the books are coming out. I think at this point, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish had come out. The first Dirk Gently book comes out because now I'm following everything Douglas Adams does. And I was lucky enough, Dreamhaven Bookstore in Uptown Minneapolis on the campus, which has now moved. And I told you about it last time I was there a few years ago it's been moved, but it's still around. Dreamhaven's still around. Here's a little trippy thing for you. I met Douglas Adams at a book signing there.
Oh, cool.
I've got a picture with him, which we should put in the show here.
Yeah, that would be really relevant. Yeah,
my dad came to get me out of school. I was like a junior in high school, I think, or a sophomore in high school. And he came to get me out of school early. I forgot how I worked this. Headed over to the campus, and I was like third person in line. Did this. And, of course, not everybody had cameras back then, you know, everywhere you went. And the two guys in front of us or behind us or something were taking pictures. And my dad, being my dad, asked them if they would mind taking a picture of me with Douglas Adams. And like, well, how are we going to get it to you? I think my dad gave him like 10 or 20 bucks or something, gave him our address. And by God, you know, a couple weeks later, I got the photo and the negative in my mailbox. These two strangers took this picture for me. So I'm very lucky to have had that. But the next thing that comes out that really ends up being the only sort of ancillary thing for hitchhikers. I mean, I think there were some towels that were done by, like, you know,
yeah, Saint, I think you Richard's, could get lots of, like, those bumper stickers, you know, from like TK sticker. Graphics, you know, don't panic, and
but there was
sayings, you know,
there was an official towel, like, was like there? In the UK, there was an official towel you could mail away for that reprinted the page on the towel was the page of the book that talked about how important towels were.
And I think so you stuff could get like a coffee mug with the benum of the book.
The thumb, yeah, it's yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah. But nothing really official, you know, kicked off. And then in 1988, I'm in a bookstore like a Walden Books or B. Dalton or something, and I come across this book called Don't Panic, The Official Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Companion. And it's written by a guy named Neil Gaiman. And ooh. It, from soup to nuts, it gives you the entire story of how he got the idea, where this went, how this went, is a movie going to happen, takes it right up to 88. And I kept it on my bookshelf forever. And then, you know, after a decade or so, whatever it was, I start seeing the name Neil Gaiman pop up and wonder if it's the same guy. And of course, it was the same guy, and they became friends as well. And then the last time I was at Dreamhaven in Minneapolis, because Neil Gaiman now lives in, I think, either Wisconsin or Minnesota.
He moved from England to Minnesota.
Yeah, he comes to Dreamhaven all the time to do book signings, and so they had a bunch of his stuff signed on the shelves. And I thought, wow, talk about a time travel moment, a strange moment. Yeah. But that's the other thing. If you've never experienced Hitchhikers as well, it's not only is it a great story, great writing, great humor, great acting. It's goofy. It's weird. It's Doctor Who-ish if you like that sort of thing. But there also is a really interesting, definitive sort of story about the nature of the universe and how it's all completely screwed up and doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and you do when you get to the when you get. That's what I really love or find charming about it is, you know, he leaves Earth and you just find that aliens are even like they're even worse.
They're worse.
They're corrupt. They're corrupt on drugs. They're
addicts.
It's just,
or they don't know what they're doing, or they don't know why these buttons work, or there's
like Zaphod is pretty much batshit crazy, and
he's like
president of the universe.
Yeah, he's insane, and you know, there's
was it? Hey, he's just this guy, you know.
It's just this guy, you know. And there's still rock music that is blowing people's brains out because it's too loud and all the same stuff. But then the nature or the fact that nobody really cares.
Yeah, there's a lot of apathy.
There's complete apathy about anything how did this get here and where did this come from or whatever. And there's a great bit with Slarty Bartfast, who is like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the story, where he meets Arthur on the surface of Magrathea. And he says, you know, he starts explaining to him how it's the mice that are, you know, doing things. And the mice have been doing the experiments on man. Oh, no, you've got it wrong. You've got it wrong. We've been doing experiments on them. Oh, really? You think so? Okay, yeah. What if they go on this way and they eat the wrong bit of cheese? Or this, you know, suddenly falling dead of myxomatosis or something. You know, that's keeping you guys on your toes. There's a much bigger thing going on here. And Arthur says something like, and the music swells. And Arthur says something like, well, you know, no, this would explain it. Oh, what do you mean? No, it would explain it because all my life I have felt that there's something going on that I didn't know about. Some greater scheme that was happening that we all weren't privy to that would explain everything that was being done. Blah, blah, blah. And then Slarty Bartfast like, yeah, it could be. Yeah, but that's probably just basic paranoia. Everyone goes through.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a whole thing about our place in the universe. Like, we're just so insignificant. Yeah.
And it's like, it could be.
Isn't there a thing in the TV series, basically? Like, I think they try to wrap it up where Arthur ends up on Earth again.
He ends up on Earth.
And it's being repopulated by basically, like, they pretended this was an ark, but all they did was send like the bottom rung of society.
Yeah. I don't want to give any spoilers, but basically the arc that they land on, you know, the captain starts describing it, says, well, wait, this is the B arc? I mean, what's the B arc? I see, you know, telephone sanitizers. I see hairdressers. I see chartered accountants in, you know, hyper sleep. What was the A arc? Oh, well, the A arc, those were all the creative people. Those are the people that came up with the ideas and that, you know, understood how to make a device or get to a certain place or medicine, doctors. Those people. And then who are the C arc? Oh, those were the builders. Those were the ones that could build the vehicles and then could make the medicine and build the pyramids, etc. Yeah. And then what are you guys? Oh, we're just, and you just slowly get the sense that, like, you're the most useless bunch of people that came from this planet, and you've been waiting for years to reconnect with the other two arcs, but really, they just got you the hell off their planet. Yeah. You're eventually going to crash someplace else because you're so useless. And eventually what happens is, through time travel or whatever, they end up crashing on the Earth.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, you know, Arthur is still – he's trying to, like, educate the cavemen and teach them how to play Scrabble and stuff. And Ford's like, why are you bothering? He goes, well, we've got to get them going because they've got a long way to go. I mean, we got to catch up in 42 million years or whatever, some million years, the Earth's going to destroy it. And Ford points to the idiots, you know, standing around a bathtub deciding what color they should paint the leaves in the forest, or if, you know, what shape a wheel should be. And he goes, I got to break it to you, Arthur. Those are your ancestors over there. Yeah. The caveman's dying out because they landed, and that's – and it's that circular, you know, logic of time travel. Like, how did we get from there to here? And it's really brilliant. I remember being devastated by that as a kid.
Yeah, I thought it just was – just thought it was really, really funny.
It's very funny, but yeah, just the hopelessness. And it's a very British,
it's bleak.
Bleak kind of
– a lot of things that came from the early 80s, though, like, had that bleakness. It's like that Thatcher era bled into everything. If you read the comic books of that time, they aren't that pleasant. Yeah. Even Time Bandits. I mean, the end of Time Bandits.
Oh, it's horrifying.
Kids' parents get killed.
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Brazil is terrifying. Yeah. In a larger way, and it's an R-rated film, but it's like, I think a lot of that has to do with the 80s paranoia and nuclear war. And
have you ever seen Threads?
Oh, have I seen Threads? I still haven't cleaned my underpants out from the first time I watched it when I was
a few years ago, a couple of years ago. Michelle said to me, you know, I want to watch like a Day After, a scary movie like The Day After, and I was like, there's nothing scarier than Threads.
There's nothing scarier.
And she goes, I'll put it on. 30 minutes in, she goes, turn it off.
It and is
like it gets worse,
and this was 1983 or 84.
Yeah,
and it was a year after The Day After, which was the big thing on ABC.
Yeah, so
it
scary.
Made The Day After look like
a
trip to Disney
party.
World.
Yeah,
and I remember the affiliate that was going to run it put out a warning. The head of the network came out and said, this is incredibly graphic, but we think it's an important thing to show. Everyone should see this. It was British made. I forget who the writer was, but he was a very pretty famous writer in the UK.
The director ended up directing The Bodyguard. Another horrific
film. Oh, yeah, you're right. I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah, no, but it's there's like no real names or faces in it. They all seem like very regular people, and it's not just what happens. It's the aftermath.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's so
Did you ever see The Road? With
Jesus, how did we get here?
I don't know. You were talking about early 80s.
Sorry, I just talk about the bleakness of it bleeds into Hitchhikers. A couple of things I wanted to talk about on this were I think there was a comic series. Do you remember the comic series? Did you pick that up?
I picked a couple of them up, but it didn't really.
Yeah, it didn't do anything for me either. And then the film did spawn merchandise. There were
it
action
did. The
figures.
The film finally did, yes.
And they just sat because nobody
they
wanted
did.
That crap.
I bought some of them though. I have.
Did you?
I have a Marvin. I have a Zaphod. I have an Arthur Dent. I think I have Marvin's gun. I have Zaphod's gun because they only made like 300 or 400 of those, like prop replicas of those.
I seem to remember. There's a store a few minutes from my house that probably still has one of the Vogons with as an action
like full
figure.
Size.
No, like
a figure.
Yeah, a figurine. Yeah. Because I don't think that anyone ever wanted one of those. That was one of the changes in the film I actually kind of liked, was that the Vogons became these complete bureaucrats.
Yeah.
I really kind of enjoyed that little... And that just was a clever little change.
And just sloth-like. And
well, you know, in like long lines. I kind of dug that part of it. And I am a fan of Zooey Deschanel.
You do like Zooey?
Oh, yeah. I think she's cute.
Well, she's cute, but...
Yeah, but she doesn't get on my nerves either. Like, I can't watch The New Girl. But if she pops up in a movie, it's a good thing for me.
Yeah, I just feel like she's been kind of doing the same.
But, I didn't know who she was then, and...
For Hitchhikers?
Yeah, and to me, she was a perfect Trillian. You know?
Yeah, I mean, she... Yeah. It worked. It worked fine because she needed to be kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky. I mean, I hated the thing at the beginning of the film when it was like, let's go to Madagascar. And he's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
And then suddenly he's not cool because he's not going to go run and get tickets to Madagascar with some lunatic woman he's never met before. Like, that stuff like that kind of irritated me. It didn't make her look too interesting. But the film is definitely worth...
I'm probably going to rewatch that after I rewatched the miniseries.
Well, I would recommend anyone to go to the miniseries first.
Is it on YouTube or like?
I don't know. BBC did a nice job putting out like a double disc thing for it, and it's also I found a really cool thing which I haven't been able to find since. But there's a German two disc set.
Usually German two disc set is usually something you can't mention in front of children.
No, exactly. one of the discs, you know, as a the book is just the show. The other disc packaged separately is all the making of content.
Oh,
but both of them are packed inside a plastic container with a pop off top that looks like the container that the guide slips into when Ford first hands it to Arthur, and it says "Don't panic" on the front. I should take a picture of it for this thing too, because it's like the closest they ever got to making a prop replica from.
Some of the most memorable stuff is the book's sequences, like talking about if you got to get a receipt at the toilet on this planet, or they'll cut your arm off.
Yeah, and so much of it. I mean, we can talk about Star Trek with the communicators that flip open, and we got cell phones, whatever. Well, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is what we were holding in our hands, you know, with our iPhones now.
Oh, it's like,
you can look anything up, and you can watch clips of it and hear music and get the information and Wikipedia and all that stuff. He saw all that coming, in a way. He set something up, I think, was called H2G2, and it was some site that was like a precursor to Wikipedia, you know, gathering information that would have been the actual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on the internet, basically. So if you like that stuff, I would go with that. Don't forget also that Douglas Adams...
He designed a video game, too, on that.
He designed Starship Titanic, which I think he wrote with Terry Jones of Monty Python. Terry Jones wrote the book that was based on the video game.
He did a Hitchhiker's game, too, remember? I remember Starship Titanic.
Yes, the Hitchhiker's game is from 1984 by... Ubisoft or someone like that. I forget. I only got it.
I haven't heard that name in years.
I only got it to get the extras that were in it.
Oh.
Which was like a little bag of a microscopic space fleet, a little bit of fluff, a button that says "Don't panic." And then they had the plan. It was a fold out little, you know, certificate plan to knock down Arthur's house. And then a similar one, like on silver paper,
you weren't big into those, like, cause it had to be one of those text games, right?
It was a text game. It was totally a text game. And I had always heard that it was impossible to get through, but he was adding content in there. So I mean, he hit every medium you can think of. Let's also not forget, as we mentioned before, Marvin got his own semi-hit single called
"I Remember That." Dr. Demento would play that.
Marvin, we love you.
Yeah.
Douglas Adams also wrote the classic stories for Doctor Who, for Tom Baker, The Pirate Planet, The City of Death, and Shada, which was never complete.
Do you like those stories?
I like City of Death. I like Pirate Planet, but he was letting too much of the comedy.
I really hate Pirate Planet.
Come into what he was doing, but I think that he and Baker hit it off, and of course he and Lala Ward hit it off. They all were kind of friends because, you know, Adams was a devout atheist and became good friends with Richard Dawkins.
Huh.
He introduced Richard Dawkins to Lala Ward.
It's no surprise that Adams was an atheist.
But isn't that a trip? No, he introduced Lala Ward to Richard Dawkins. Douglas Adams is responsible for those two getting together. Well, Ramana Mark II from Doctor Who, and Richard Dawkins got together because of Douglas Adams. But also, he did write two other books: Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Yeah.
And The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul.
I remember that.
I enjoy both of them, but the first one I think is much better. And they not only have they now done radio versions, they've got everyone back that was available. Not only everyone back that was available, they brought voices in for smaller parts. Like David Dixon shows up in a scene between he and Arthur, but he's playing a different character because Jeffrey McGivern plays Ford throughout the whole thing.
Right.
Everyone, Jonathan Pryce was in the second radio series back in 78. He shows up as Zarni Whoop in one of the episodes in this. So you can get them on CD. They have now gone back and in the past 10 years or so recorded official audio, like radio show style versions of Life, the Universe, and Everything, So Long, Thanks for All the Fish, and Mostly Harmless. So they finished those.
I really like actually the culture in the UK. I've been diagnosed as an auditory learner. I really love radio. And
it's still huge.
They do all these audio dramas. Like I look at it and go, I should really be getting in on this because, they have Doctor Who's. Like they just announced a new season of Doctor Who with Catherine Tate and David Tennant.
That's right.
They do Torchwood. They do Blake 7.
And all the comedy too. All the comedy shows that start as a radio thing, like League of Gentlemen and The Mighty Boosh was a radio series before it became a show, and brilliant stuff like that. So they went back and did all those, and then they went even further and they recorded the two Dirk Gently books as like audio shows, like radio type shows, those are worth. But even more interesting, and this is where we'll kind of wrap it up. There was a Dirk Gently TV series done in the UK, only three episodes. Stephen Mangan was the lead actor. The other guy that's in it, it's great. I can't think of his name. He's brilliant. He's in all the Steve Coogan stuff. Real tall, handsome fella. He's in it, and they're quite good. There's only three of them, but the first one kind of sticks to the first bits of the first novel pretty well. And the last thing I heard was that either a TV series or a comic book or something was supposed to be coming to fruition for Dirk Gently. And it was being handled by your buddy and mine, Max Landis. He was going to be doing it.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was a joke, by the way. I was being sarcastic.
I don't know Max Landis.
Yeah. I know how much you love him.
But I just don't care.
Well, you should. Yeah. You really should because...
Well, no. I mean, I made that joke and I publicly said it and I'll say it on this. I don't know why I would want to listen to his opinion.
Exactly.
Sometimes his dad annoys me in a documentary and that sort of thing, but he's also the guy who made American Werewolf in London and Kentucky Fried Movie.
Right.
But I've never seen anything by Max Landis. I've never read anything I've liked about him, so his opinion is as valid as mine, you know?
No, yours is definitely more valid than his, I promise you. So I guess that was kind of it for the Hitchhiker film. Like, there's never – I don't think there's going to be a sequel or anything else.
I think it's a little late, yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe it should just be what it is, but it's such a strong idea and it's so beloved that I would be shocked if someone somewhere didn't come along and do something with it. Just a couple quick music references as well. In the original radio series of Hitchhikers, Marvin hums a bit of "Shine On, You Crazy Diamond," you know, out of his chest plate kind of thing. And they couldn't do it for subsequent versions. So there's Pink Floyd. He loves the Beatles. I think Trillian starts singing A Day in Life when they're about to die.
That's right.
And he was a big fan of Procol Harum as well, you know, Whiter Shade of Pale and Long Gone Geek and stuff like that. And they've got an album called Grand Hotel. And the title track on this album, when he was writing Hitchhikers and he was thinking about Milliways and the end of the universe and how this cabaret night was going to go, where everything would da-da-da-da-da-da and build up. And the inspiration was the midsection of that tune of Grand Hotel by Procol Harum, where it just starts to go off the rails. And he thought, you know, if the best way to describe this is it almost sounds like the universe is about to explode. And that became the inspiration for the Milliways thing. Mm-hmm. You know, bits of Hitchhiker stuff pop up into music. I mean, and Doctor Who. In David Tennant's first episode, The Christmas Invasion, he talked about his pajamas, his dressing gown. He said, "I feel very Arthur Dent."
I think there's more than that. I think there's quite a few little Hitchhiker's eggs in Doctor Who. I remember that one specifically, but I think there's many, many more than that, and maybe some folks can point them out, because I'm positive I've read more than one of those.
Yeah, is there another one that pops into mind?
I think Moffat's written some in. That's the big one, but now that you mention it, I have to think there's been some Hitchhiker's references in Doctor Who. You hang on one second, I'll see if I can't find it.
While Brian's doing that, I'll talk about some other things that have been influenced by Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or vice versa. Radiohead, of course, most famously, their first single off of their second record, OK Computer. Sorry, third album, OK Computer, is called Paranoid Android. Has nothing to do with Marvin the Paranoid Android, but that's what it's called anyway.
Yeah.
They also had a B-side where they mention there's a TARDIS inside my head or something on a B-side the Radiohead did. But somebody else did something with either Marvin or Hitchhiker or Zaphod. Oh, well, also in the soundtrack of the film was done by a guy called Joby Talbot, who is did the theme for the League of Gentlemen comedy series and does music with the Divine Comedy with Neil Hannon. And so Neil Hannon did a couple of tunes in the movie, So Long and Thanks for All the Fish, and then Vote for Beeblebrox, which is a song I don't think that was ever used in the film except for in the backgrounds. And then, of course, the theme of the series – the actual musical, the banjo musical intro of the radio series, the television series, the film, everything is called Journey of the Sorcerer.
Yeah.
And it was off of an Eagles record. Was the Eagles album Desperado or something? Was that what it was off of?
I don't actually know.
My whole life I thought it was had to be a different Eagles.
Like, yeah.
I believe it would be the same thing, but it is.
Wow.
So there's a lot of cool. And Neil Hannon also wrote for Doctor Who for that Christmas, the same Christmas special. You know, Love Don't Pay No Mind, or My Love Don't Roam, or whatever. So lots of musical stuff as well that I dig or been into, and bands that have, you know, jumped in and out of Hitchhikers and Doctor Who, of course.
Now, the very first Doctor Who Hitchhikers reference actually comes from the original series. And that is the Seventh Doctor once asked who had said that Earthmen rarely invite their ancestors to dinner.
Oh.
So, and then, of course,
it was the book, and the line is something like, yeah, Earthmen are not proud of their ancestors and rarely invite them around for dinner.
Yeah, there hasn't been a ton that's picked out here, but Rory also referred to the asteroid he traveled to as the junkyard of the end of the universe.
Oh, okay. All right.
So there's that as well.
That's good, yeah. And then there was the dressing gown where he said, I like this outfit, very Arthur Dent.
Yes, that's probably the big bomb.
Yeah.
But, no.
It's just, some things, look, we talk about stuff on the show that we love. It doesn't mean that everybody has to love this stuff or that we're right or that it's the greatest thing ever. Some things we talk about are never going to rise above, you know, like much as we, love...
Hang on. What the heck is that? Are you there?
Am I interrupting your workout?
I have no idea where that came from.
I like the dump.
You know what? I'm on. That must have been the page I went to. Sounded like either I was watching an 80s workout video or pornography. Or both.
Now I know why you get so distracted when we're doing the show. All those sounds in the background.
Well, that's why I'm mostly just,
But yeah. Something, you know, so, like I'm trying to say that some things, Micronauts or Buckaroo Bonds or whatever it is, it's like they'll never be a globally, you know, embraced kind of thing. They'll always be popular and interesting and have love for them.
Because they are cult, though.
But some things have endured and are popular and leave a mark because they are so brilliant. And I think The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if it was just that, if it was just the TV series, to me, and I keep going back to the TV series because as brilliant as everything else is with, you know, the two radio shows, the albums, the books, things that come in and out of there, if I had to pick a definitive, I would pick that, A, because it's the first thing I was exposed to, but B, because for me, it is the most concise and linear telling of the story. It is the leanest and comes right around to the end, full stop, and you're done.
Yeah, you do feel satisfied with that.
You feel that's the word. It's the most satisfying telling of the story, I think. Because sometimes the book can get a little far off left or right and you don't know where it's going. And I think that's the way to go. But I couldn't be more pleased that we got to do this
for
this episode and also to recognize it's episode 42 and we were able to do this. Douglas Adams was a big hero of mine and he was a humanitarian. He cared about the environment and
I think
atheist, and he was a bit of a genius, and he was also a real computer freak.
Yeah,
I think he had one of the first Apple Macintosh computers ever, and he was a incredibly interested in technology, which I'm not, but he was more interested as his life went on. He got more interested in the trying to keep hitchhikers going or other things going so that he could afford to go to these places and have these trips and get to the middle of the Amazon for a TV special or something about endangered species and give back that way with whatever notoriety that he had. And so he was kind of a genius in many departments, and he was taken away from us far too soon.
Yeah, he left this earth way too young, and he was a healthy guy too. It was a hardening of the arteries that he didn't even know about. He died at the gym.
Yeah. He died at the gym in LA.
Yeah. I think when you look at something like Hitchhikers, its legacy is sometimes the things it's inspired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like, you know, there's we all know influential bands that didn't get the success you feel they deserved, even though they're on everyone's lips, you know, or everyone has their T-shirt. You know, like the Ramones were not multimillionaires, but what they inspired is their legacy. And I think there's a lot of things that you could watch on Cartoon Network now or just in many places, and you can go, I can see how Hitchhikers influenced the creators of this, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You watch like a Rick and Morty, and there's definitely some credence to Hitchhikers in that.
Yes, because it has the, whereas you know, Hitchhiker, I mean, yeah, Hitchhiker's perspective on time travel and or the universe is different than, say, Bob's Gale and Bob Zemeckis' view for something like Back to the Future,
yeah,
where it's you know, if you go back and you change this and the butterfly flaps the wings and this will happen and your mother can't do this because then you'll only be born. It's a little simple and kind of, you know, it's fun, but that's the old, you know, time travel thing. Whereas the Hitchhiker's one is kind of like, it throws all of that into a cocked hat, and out the other side also says, none of it matters. None of this is going to make any difference. It's all just a roll of the dice.
And that's why I kind of threw Rick and Morty in there, is that it's a very dark show as well.
It is very dark, yeah.
It would
explain his atheism. It would also explain that would be something that he would feel strongly about, that there are no answers, and so the absurdity. I mean, there's something that he talked about in it's a Hitchhiker thing, but it's based on an actual creature. Like I'm going to get this completely wrong, but it's based on, it's like the Babel fish, the thing that you can stick in your ear and then instantly understand anything. But it is but because of that, it has caused more bloody wars and more disease and anything else because of it. And he was talking about, it was comparing that to some creature, this little creature that. Every time it flew, it like bumped its bum. Like it would take one little flight and then boom, it hit its bum and go over and boom. And it was that's the way it had to move. And he was talking about it. I'm getting this wrong, but he was talking about it in just something so incredibly intricate and amazing as this creature that some higher power must have come up with. And yet it is fundamentally flawed and can't get off the ground, you know, can't do this in a logical way, kind of, which is, I think, how he sees the universe and, you know, faith, basically. Nothing against faith, everybody, if you've got it. But so there you go. There's our Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy 42nd episode.
I don't have a Hitchhiker's quote to end with, so I'm just going to say good night, everybody.
Well, I'll say here'll be my Hitchhiker's quote. It'll be, Brian, what would you do if I told you that I wasn't from Minneapolis after all, but was actually from somewhere, a small planet in the vicinity of Betelgeuse? And then you say, I don't know. Is that the sort of thing that you're likely to say?
Yeah. And then I say, forgotten my lines.
And then I say, drink up. The world's about to end.
You know, next episode, why don't you just act it out? I bet you could.
I could.
I'll do the sound effects.
That's the line I always say to people, is drink up, the world's about to end. Like, whatever it is being thrown at you, it's like, drink up. You know, shit that's going on right now with Trump and everything else, is just like, drink up, the world is definitely about to end. We are in the end of days, so drink up. That's my message for the day.
Oh, well, that's a happy ending.